Water, Wisconsin, and the Mercury Cycle, a production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute, with funding provided by the United States Geological Survey. Mercury 2014. Mats and fracking, bleeding mercury, and the Minamata Convention. Welcome back. This is Chris Bocast from the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. In this second update on developments in the field of mercury research, I continue my conversation with David Krabbenhoft, a prominent research scientist at the Wisconsin Water Science Center. Dealing with environmental challenges is hard work. To really solve a problem takes more than figuring out what is going on in an ecosystem. Economic and cultural elements always factor into that equation. And that's why one of the topics that David was most eager to share with me was the progress that has taken place in international regulation and the politics of mercury. David explains.
Two notable things have happened that I think will change environmental conditions for the better, and notably over the coming decade. The first one actually occurred in December of 2011. And that was the promulgation by the United States Environmental Protection Agency of what we call the MATS rule, the Mercury and Air Toxic Substances rule, that requires a substantial reduction in the amount of mercury emissions emanating from electric generating utilities that derive their power either from coal or burning oil. What that will do is eliminate about 50% of the remaining portfolio of mercury emissions from the United States. So we'll have eliminated from at least the United States inventory of emissions dating back as recently as the 70s, about 80% of the mercury that our country was emitting to the skies back then. So a significant accomplishment and certainly a good environmental story that hopefully we build on moving forward. The second one, and bigger in scale, is what we refer to as the Minamata Convention on Mercury. And what that is a treaty and a legally binding instrument that was agreed upon in January of 2013 in Geneva, Switzerland, by the vast majority of the countries on Earth who all agreed to the reductions that are described in there that are very broad. They include everything from, much like the MATS rule, a reduction in the amount of mercury that can come from electric power generation, but also they address industries such as gold mining, where developing countries are agreeing to do the best they can to cut back on the use of mercury as the extractant for gold in gold mining operations and use other processes that are far less impactful to the ecosystem after the mining is done. Countries like the United States and other developed countries are going to help out those other countries to develop the non-mercury use mining practices. But there's also large sectors of manufacturing that use mercury currently that are going to be under the Minamata Convention. So things like personal care products, and I think that's a little known use of mercury. There's historically been a lot of mercury used in personal care products.
Such as hairspray?
A common one that's been used by people on large scales over the years are skin whiteners, creams that are used to make your skin appear more uniform and get rid of dark spots. Whiteners actually contained phenomenally high amounts of mercury. And there are now other creams and ointments that can be used, non-mercury containing, that can accomplish the same objective as far as your desired cosmetic outcome without exposing yourself to such gross amounts of mercury. That industry has also agreed to develop and use non-mercury manufacturing processes, so we'll eliminate a lot of human exposure that way as well. But in total, it's a really significant environmental victory that will lead to what we hopefully will see in not too long down the road, improved mercury exposure levels in the environment, and ultimately fish and other consumables that will contain less mercury.
And you can eat as many walleye as you want?
That's what we hope. That's ultimately what I think any environmental resource management group would hope for, is that we can in the future have no concern for the amount of walleye that you eat when you go on your family vacation or if you go to the supermarket. Ultimately, we hope to get to that position someday. However, like any other contamination issue that mankind has encountered previously, mercury's no different. It doesn't recover instantaneously. There's always a memory effect of the contamination that has gone on before, and that will also occur for mercury. That's one of the interesting areas of research that's ongoing right now, is trying to understand what the lag times are going to be for various ecosystems. And that includes everything in scale from a system as large as the Pacific Ocean to a very small creek or wetland, maybe in your backyard. It might surprise you to hear that the scale of something like the Pacific Ocean isn't necessarily going to have the longest lag time to recovery. In fact, quite the opposite. And that's where researchers are really focusing in now and trying to understand, where does the mercury come from that feeds the methylation cycle that eventually contributes to the mercury in consumable fish? In a significant number of cases, it might come as a surprise to some listeners that the small watershed, maybe here in Wisconsin, might receive legacy mercury from the soils and sediments in that watershed for a very long time, so-called bleeding mercury, extending out the time period of recovery for, unfortunately, maybe several decades to maybe 100 years or more. Whereas a system like Lake Superior, you know, the largest lake on the planet, or maybe an ocean like the Pacific Ocean, it might show demonstrable recovery in a few short years to certainly within 10 years. And so those are some of the interesting things that we're looking at, because as we look outwardly at some of these very significant agreements like the Matz Rule or the Minamata Convention, we can start to wonder how soon until we get a better, less mercury contaminated source of fish and shellfish. That is something that I think we'll continue to evaluate moving forward. But we've seen some early hints that have surprised us, how maybe our preconceived notions about where we get our mercury locally come from. The best example I can allude to there is some really dramatic declines in atmospheric mercury that people are seeing now in various locations, at least in North America for sure, but I believe it's being seen in other locations across the world. But more specifically, what I'm referring to is when we made atmospheric mercury measurements as recently as a decade or 15 years ago, we would see a concentration of gaseous mercury in the air of about 1.8 nanograms per cubic meter. And more recently, when we make these measurements in the same location, we're seeing concentrations in those same locations of about 1.1 to maybe 1.3 nanograms per standard cubic meter. As we look at these data and we think back on published reports that occurred maybe 10 and 15 years ago, those reports suggested to us that even if we could eliminate 90% of all our domestic mercury emissions, the largest response that we would see in a location like northern Wisconsin would be about 5 or 10%. So if we think back historically, 10 or 15 years ago, on the measurements we made then of air concentration of about 1.8 nanograms per standard cubic meter, if those modeled projections of a maximum improvement, even if we could shut down all our domestic emissions, the implication back then was that if it would only decline 10 or 15%, what that led us to believe was that about 90 to 95% of the mercury in the air in a location like rural Wisconsin was coming from non-US sources. Some of the big ones being, of course, India and China. Well, the very large decline effect of what we've seen, a decline of more like 30 or 40% or so, again coming from a concentration of about 1.8 down to about 1.3 to 1.1 nanograms per standard cubic meter, is a much larger decline than we would have anticipated based on the models of only about a decade ago. And what that leads us to conclude is, in fact, our local emissions, our emissions from here in North America and in the United States more specifically, are more important to what we see locally than what we thought previously. What that can lead us to conclude is that under full implementation of the United States Matz Rule, which will require, again, 90% reduction of mercury emissions coming from electric generating utilities, that we might in fact see a much larger improvement than we thought previously. One of the things that we are thinking about now is, well, why? If the MATS rule really didn't have regulatory teeth, per se, until this coming December of 2014, why have we seen this decline in advance of the MATS rule? It's interesting to think about, and I can't point to a study that definitively shows concrete proof of this, but the discussions that have gone on about this to date largely focus on the really dramatic change in the use of natural gas in our country as opposed to using coal to generate electric power. And that's all come about because of fracking. Previous to widespread use of fracking in the last decade, there was vast reservoirs of natural gas and oil in areas such as North Dakota, where we've known about those oil and gas reservoirs for a very long period of time. We just had no economical way to get it out of the ground. And with the advent of the fracking method, the available domestic resource of natural gas and oil has totally changed the pricing structure of natural gas versus coal. So whereas before it was cheaper to burn coal to generate electricity for many locations, a large number of facilities now have switched over to natural gas because of the pricing. And because the amount of mercury in natural gas is extremely low compared to coal, we've actually had an early indication of what the overall impact of what the MATS rule might be because of the switching over from coal to natural gas. And that's what we believe is behind the decline in gaseous mercury concentrations here in the United States in many areas, all areas where we believe the causal reason is an early switchover to natural gas. And that might give us an early look at what might happen under the full implementation of the MATS rule.
Well, all that news should give you something to think about. Be sure and keep listening for more upcoming podcasts about water news and research from the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute. This is Chris Bocast. Till next time. Water, Wisconsin, and the Mercury Cycle is a production of the University of Wisconsin Water Resources Institute, with funding provided by the United States Geological Survey. Thanks for listening.